This is Audible.
HMH Audio presents A Good Man is Hard to Find and Other Stories, written by Flannery O'Connor with an introduction by Lauren Groff, read by Marguerite Gavin.
For Sally and Robert Fitzgerald. Introduction. A Good Man is Hard to Find is the most American book I know. By this I mean that it speaks of the hypocrisies of the American soul in microcosm. It is an eruption of the particular half-buried traumas of the Jim Crow South, as seen by a brave, blazingly angry, and mordantly funny observer. Before the collection came out, no American writer had ever written stories with as much comedy and moral fire as Flannery O'Connor. Which is why when it arrived on the literary scene in 1955, it hit like a lightning bolt and made the writer, quite justly, famous. Even after nearly 70 years, this book remains just as powerful today as it was on publication day, despite the fact that the writer's influence has seeped so deeply into American short fiction that you can taste it in the groundwater. If imitators of O'Connor abound, it is because it is hard for any writer to escape the influence of such force and originality in subject and structure. But if you look even more deeply into American culture, you'll find that even those souls among us who are neither writers nor readers have been changed by the writer's gimlet eye, as the distorted and somewhat grotesque idea of the South, as it appears in popular culture, is in large part the legacy of O'Connor. Although her name looms hugely over the literary landscape, O'Connor published only two books in her lifetime. Her debut, the very strange and powerful novel Wise Blood, which was received by critics with some ambivalence, and her second book, A Good Man is Hard to Find. Her other two books, the utterly brilliant story collection Everything That Rises Must Converge, and the novel The Violent Bear It Away, were published posthumously. She was born Mary Flannery O'Connor in Savannah in 1925, a pigeon-toed child with a receding chin and a leave-me-alone-or-I'll-bite-you complex, as she later wrote of herself. Her family moved in 1940 to a working dairy farm called Andalusia in Milledgeville, Georgia, which would be her home for the rest of her life, which is now a museum honoring the writer. When O'Connor was still in high school, her father died of lupus, a painful and incurable disease in which the body's immune system attacks healthy parts of the body, a loss that devastated her and prefigured her own death at an early age. She began to write for her high school paper, but her first truly creative calling was in cartooning, blocky and carefully composed lino cuts, compositions of stark white lines on a deep black ground, not unlike her later fiction, which even then bore her singular wryness. She continued her journalism and cartooning at Georgia State College for Women, after which she first attended graduate school at the University of Iowa to study journalism, until she decided journalism wasn't for her, and pleaded her way into the Iowa Writers' Workshop to write fiction. When she was 32, O'Connor was diagnosed with lupus, the same disease that had killed her father. For the rest of her life, save a few trips to give lectures and readings, she lived quietly at Andalusia with her mother, going to daily mass, writing, and raising her peacocks. She would die of complications of her disease in 1964, before her 40th birthday. Hers was a short life, but a powerfully creative and influential one. Although O'Connor was herself a Southerner, A Good Man is Hard to Find could not be nearly as good as it is if the writer weren't also an outsider, made all her life to stand in the chilly shadows because she was a highly educated and highly critical woman at a time when the gender roles of a soft and amiable Southern femininity were rigidly enforced. And, more importantly, because of her devout Catholicism in the largely fundamentalist Protestant South. At the deepest, most molten core of all of O'Connor's work is her Catholicism, Or, as she says, the stinking mad shadow of Jesus. Every story she wrote hinges upon her character's stain of original sin, and what grace they are sometimes allowed is hard-won, fleeting, and almost always too late to make much of a difference in the end. Her violence, which is the most shocking and immediately apparent attribute of her work, is the violence of Catholicism, a religion in which the central symbol, fondled on a rosary, hung over the bed, worn on a necklace at the throat, is a crucifix, an aestheticized rendering of the bloody, suffering, broken body of Jesus after he was nailed to a cross and left in the sun to die. She saw her Catholicism in harsh opposition to the wishy-washy moral relativism of the mostly agnostic or atheistic writers of her time. You can't indicate moral values when morality changes with what is being done, because there is no accepted basis of judgment, she writes in an essay in Mystery and Manners. And you cannot show the operation of grace when grace is cut off from nature, or when the very possibility of grace is denied, because no one will have the least idea of what you are about. The Christian novelist is distinguished from his pagan colleagues by recognizing sin as sin. According to his heritage, he sees it not as sickness or an accident of environment, but as a responsible choice of offense against God, which involves his eternal future. Either one is serious about salvation, or one is not. And it is well to realize that the maximum amount of seriousness admits the maximum amount of comedy. Only if we are secure in our beliefs can we see the comical side of the universe. One reason a great deal of our contemporary fiction is humorless is because so many of these writers are relativists and have to be continually justifying the actions of their characters on a sliding scale of values. Only when you are as immovable in your beliefs as bedrock can you then become a subversive, O'Connor is saying here. And out of her Catholic moral center comes her second most subversive attribute as a writer, that of her deep and roiling humor. O'Connor's humor is just as seditious as her equally ostensibly unfeminine violence. And in many ways the humor is the element that makes the violence palatable. If a reader has no understanding of the humor deep in the bones of the stories, that reader will likely not be able to swallow the stories at all. It was with the sense of outraged irony that O'Connor discovered that her German publisher, only a few short years from the horrors of the Holocaust, wanted to pull a few of her stories from its edition because they would be too shocking for German sensibilities. "I didn't think I was that vicious," she wrote a friend dryly. Comedy in O'Connor manifests in countless ways. In tonal irony, in dialogue which characters inadvertently reveal their moral lapses, in the perfect and telling detail. It is this last in which I find O'Connor's greatest genius. When I remember the title story, A Good Man is Hard to Find, I remember the sociopathy of the murderer, the misfit, pity seeing the querulous cat that causes the car accident, the mother's cabbagey face under a bandana tied into rabbit ears, the father's yellow shirt with bright blue parrots on it. But most of all, I remember the poor chained monkey in the yard of Red Sammy Butts's restaurant, whose small, suffering, flea-bitten body seems to contain in miniature form the emblem of all of man's cruelty. So much of O'Connor's humor resides in the perfect and telling detail. Hogajoy's yellow sweatshirt with a faded cowboy on a horse embossed on it, in Good Country People. The child in A Temple of the Holy Ghost, who believes baby rabbits are born by the mother spitting them out of her mouth. The way in The River, the little boy Bevel believes that pigs are small, fat, pink animals with curly tails and round grinning faces and bow ties. Until other boys play a practical joke on him and he's pushed over and chased by a real pig, whose face is gray, wet, and sour. O'Connor's contemporary and admirer, the poet Elizabeth Bishop, wrote that she was sure that O'Connor's few books will live on and on in American literature. They are narrow, possibly, but they are clear, hard, vivid, and full of bits of description, phrases, and an odd insight that contains more real poetry than a dozen books of poems. This is high praise indeed. If a book is to live for decades, as A Good Man Is Hard to Find has done, it must be flexible. It must bend and shift under the various pressures of the changing world, which the author at the time of writing couldn't possibly foresee. Since the book was published, we in the culture at large have become aware of the tremendous violence that a single word can contain, and a modern audience has to address the fact that O'Connor frequently uses the N-word, one of the most hurtful and hideous epithets in the English language, meant to degrade and dehumanize black people. It's worse to see that the writer uses it with seeming relish, even titling his story, The Artificial Nigger. Some people may try to defend O'Connor by saying that the word didn't fully hold the freight when she was alive as it holds now, that the word was commonly used in the South at the time, and the use of it was in service of verisimilitude. But these are explanations that go only so far, because surely O'Connor, with her subtle understanding of cruelty and pain, knew how hideous the appellation was, how much violence it carries. The question of intended audience is important, and it seems clear from her nonfiction writing that O'Connor imagined her readers to be the white, male, mostly atheistic writers who filled her fiction classes at Iowa. It seems equally likely that it never struck her that she would be read by people of color, and that her choices could hurt them. At the same time, it should be said that O'Connor's very purpose in The Artificial Nigger is to point out the savagery and hypocrisy of the racist grandfather in the story, who wants to fetter his grandson's life so that the boy becomes as small-minded and ugly as he himself is. O'Connor wrote in her nonfiction, "Our salvation is a drama played out with the devil, a devil who is not simply generalized evil, but an evil intelligence determined on its own supremacy." And this story illustrates her idea that the devil is found in everyday individuals who, like the grandfather, believe themselves inherently superior to other human beings. The story illuminates the devil buried deep in the soul of the man. No one can decide on behalf of any individual reader whether O'Connor's use of the word is justified or not, and whether it can be explained away by historical context. I'm personally on the fence, and the fence feels pretty wobbly. In the end, though, I do believe that it's not all that useful to avoid reading an influential and important author because of her problematic writing, nor is it helpful to run away from a thorough and respectful discussion of racism, both structural and tacit, because of queasiness or guilt or a lack of tools to understand foundational racism and its reverberations. Instead, it should be the work of all of us, who live within a profoundly and systematically racist system, to open the door, to seek to think about race in as complex a way as we can understand it, to hold respectful and intelligent discussions about it, and to do our best to learn from the understanding of others. I am one of the many people on whom O'Connor's magic has worked at a deep level, and I return to her story collections often to reread them as I try to understand this insane, wild, joyously, darkly hypocritical country of ours. The greatest lesson I have learned from the writer is not that the world is inherently unjust and indifferent to suffering, but that a person who struggles to be good needs to rage with every fiber of her being against this injustice and indifference, against the moral turpitude that allows evil to enter our souls. A writer's role, O'Connor also tells us, is not to be a dispassionate recorder or mirror of this injustice, but to write out of an immovable and fiery ethical core in opposition to it. Yet even without this constant and urgent reminder of moral responsibility, O'Connor can teach us any number of things. Perhaps the most beautiful of all of these lessons, and the one that deserves to be shouted from the rooftops and heard by everyone, is that we should all pay attention to the mingled beauty and ridiculousness of the people around us, that we should seek to understand them through humor, which, as in the stories of Flannery O'Connor, is at its best and most effective when it is equal parts deadly weapon and act of grace. Lauren Groff. for Sally and Robert Fitzgerald. A good man is hard to find. The grandmother didn't want to go to Florida. She wanted to visit some of her connections in East Tennessee, and she was seizing at every chance to change Bailey's mind. Bailey was the son she lived with, her only boy. He was sitting on the edge of his chair at the table, bent over the orange sports section of the journal. "Now look here, Bailey," she said. "See here, read this." And she stood with one hand on her thin hip and the other rattling the newspaper at his bald head. "Here this fellow that calls himself the Misfit is a loose from the federal pen and headed toward Florida. And you read here what it says he did to these people. Just you read it. I wouldn't take my children in any direction with a criminal like that a loose in it. I couldn't answer my conscience if I did." Bailey didn't look up from his reading, so she wheeled around then and faced the children's mother, a young woman in slacks whose face was as broad and innocent as a cabbage and was tied around with a green headkerchief that had two points on the top, like rabbit's ears. She was sitting on the sofa, feeding the baby his apricots out of a jar. "The children have been to Florida before," the old lady said. "You all ought to take them somewhere else for a change, so they would see different parts of the world and be broad. They never have been to East Tennessee." The children's mother didn't seem to hear her, but the 8-year-old boy, John Wesley, a stocky child with glasses, said, "If you don't want to go to Florida, why don't you stay at home?" He and the little girl June Star were reading the funny papers on the floor. "She wouldn't stay at home to be queen for a day," June Star said, without raising her yellow head. "Yes, and what would you do if this fella, the Misfit, caught you?" the grandmother asked. "I'd smack his face," John Wesley said. "She wouldn't stay at home for $1 million," June Star said. "Afraid she'd miss something. She has to go everywhere we go." "All right, miss," the grandmother said. "Just remember that the next time you want me to curl your hair." June Star said her hair was naturally curly. The next morning, the grandmother was the first one in the car, ready to go. She had her big black valise that looked like the head of a hippopotamus in one corner, and underneath it she was hiding a basket with Pitty Sing, the cat, in it. She didn't intend for the cat to be left alone in the house for 3 days, because he would miss her too much, and she was afraid he might brush against one of the gas burners and accidentally asphyxiate himself. Her son, Bailey, didn't like to arrive in a motel with a cat. She sat in the middle of the back seat with John Wesley and June Star on either side of her. Bailey and the children's mother and the baby sat in front, and they left Atlanta at 8:45 with the mileage on the car at 55,890. The grandmother wrote this down because she thought it would be interesting to say how many miles they had been when they got back. It took them 20 minutes to reach the outskirts of the city. The old lady settled herself comfortably, removing her white cotton gloves and putting them up with her purse on the shelf in front of the back window. The children's mother still had on slacks and still had her head tied up in a green kerchief, but the grandmother had on a navy blue straw sailor hat with a bunch of white violets on the brim and a navy blue dress with a small white dot in the print. Her collars and cuffs were white organdy trimmed with lace, and at her neckline she had pinned a purple spray of cloth violets containing a sachet. In case of an accident, anyone seeing her dead on the highway would know at once that she was a lady. She said she thought it was going to be a good day for driving, neither too hot nor too cold, and she cautioned Bailey that the speed limit was 55 miles an hour, and that the patrolmen hid themselves behind billboards and small clumps of trees and sped out after you before you had a chance to slow down. She pointed out interesting details of the scenery. Stone Mountain, the blue granite that in some places came up to both sides of the highway, the brilliant red clay banks slightly streaked with purple, and the various crops that made rows of green lacework on the ground. The trees were full of silver-white sunlight, and the meanest of them sparkled. The children were reading comic magazines, and their mother had gone back to sleep. "Let's go through Georgia fast so we won't have to look at it much," John Wesley said. "If I were a little boy," said the grandmother, "I wouldn't talk about my native state that way. Tennessee has the mountains, and Georgia has the hills." "Tennessee is just a hillbilly dumping ground,"
John Wesley said. And Georgia's a lousy state, too.
You said it,
June Star said. In my time, said the grandmother, folding her thin-veined fingers, children were more respectful of their native states and their parents and everything else. People did right then.
Oh, look at the cute little pickaninny, she said, and pointed to a Negro child standing in the door of a shack.
Wouldn't that make a picture now? She asked, and they all turned and looked at the little Negro out of the back window. He waved.
He didn't have any britches on, June Star said.
He probably didn't have any, the grandmother explained. Little niggers in the country don't have things like we do. If I could paint, I'd paint that picture, she said.
The children exchanged comic books. The grandmother offered to hold the baby, and the children's mother passed him over the front seat to her. She set him on her knee and bounced him and told him about the things they were passing. She rolled her eyes and screwed up her mouth and stuck her leathery thin face into his smooth, bland one. Occasionally, he gave her a faraway smile. They passed a large cotton field, with five or six graves fenced in the middle of it, like a small island.
Look at the graveyard, the grandmother said, pointing it out. That was the old family burying ground. That belonged to the plantation.
Where's the plantation? John Wesley asked.
Gone with the wind, said the grandmother.
Ha-ha.
When the children finished all the comic books they had brought, they opened the lunch and ate it. The grandmother ate a peanut butter sandwich and an olive, and would not let the children throw the box and the paper napkins out the window. When there was nothing else to do, they played a game by choosing a cloud and making the other two guess what shape it suggested. John Wesley took one the shape of a cow, and June Star guessed a cow, and John Wesley said no, an automobile. And June Star said he didn't play fair, and they began to slap each other over the grandmother. The grandmother said she would tell them a story if they would keep quiet. When she told a story, she rolled her eyes and waved her head and was very dramatic. She said once when she was a maiden lady, she had been courted by Mr. Edgar Atkins Tea Garden from Jasper, Georgia. She said he was a very good-looking man and a gentleman, and that he brought her a watermelon every Saturday afternoon with his initials cut in it, E-A-T. Well, one Saturday, she said, Mr. Teagarden brought the watermelon, and there was nobody at home, and he left it on the front porch and returned in his buggy to Jasper. But she never got the watermelon, she said, because a nigger boy ate it when he saw the initials E-A-T. This story tickled John Wesley's funny bone, and he giggled and giggled, but June Star didn't think it was any good. She said she wouldn't marry a man that just brought her a watermelon on Saturday. The grandmother said she would have done well to marry Mr. Teagarden, because he was a gentleman and had bought Coca-Cola stock when it first came out, and that he had died only a few years ago, a very wealthy man. They stopped at the tower for barbecued sandwiches. The tower was a part stucco and part wood filling station and dance hall, set in a clearing outside of Timothy. A fat man named Red Sammy Butts ran it, and there were signs stuck here and there on the building and for miles up and down the highway saying, Try Red Sammy's famous barbecue. None like famous Red Sammy's. Red Sam, the fat boy with the happy laugh. A veteran. Red Sammy's your man. Red Sammy was lying on the bare ground outside the tower, with his head under a truck, while a gray monkey about a foot high, chained to a small chinaberry tree, chattered nearby. The monkey sprang back into the tree and got on the highest limb, as soon as he saw the children jump out of the car and run toward him. Inside, the tower was a long, dark room, with a counter at one end, and tables at the other, and dancing space in the middle. They all sat down at a board table next to the Nickelodeon, and Red Sam's wife, a tall, burnt-brown woman with hair and eyes lighter than her skin, came and took their order. The children's mother put a dime in the machine and played the Tennessee Waltz, and the grandmother said that tune always made her want to dance. She asked Bailey if he would like to dance, but he only glared at her. He didn't have a naturally sunny disposition like she did, and trips made him nervous. The grandmother's brown eyes were very bright. She swayed her head from side to side and pretended she was dancing in her chair.
Junestar said play something she could tap to, so the children's mother put in another dime and played a fast number, and Junestar stepped out onto the dance floor and did her tap routine. "Ain't she cute?" Red Sam's wife said, leaning over the counter.
"Would you like to come be my little girl?"
"No, I certainly wouldn't," Junestar said. "I wouldn't live in a broken-down place like this for $1 million." And she ran back to the table.
"Ain't she cute?"
the woman repeated, stretching her mouth politely.
"Aren't you ashamed?" hissed the grandmother.
Red Sam came in and told his wife to quit lounging on the counter and hurry up with these people's order. His khaki trousers reached just to his hip bones, and his stomach hung over them like a sack of meal swaying under his shirt. He came over and sat down at a table nearby and let out a combination sigh and yodel.
"You can't win,"
he said.
"You can't win."
And he wiped his sweating red face off with a gray handkerchief.
"These days you don't know who to trust," he said. "Ain't that the truth?"
"People are certainly not nice like they used to be," said the grandmother.
"Two fellers come in here last week," Red Sammy said, "driving a Chrysler. It was an old beat-up car, but it was a good one, and these boys looked all right to me. Said they worked at the mill, and you know I let them fellers charge the gas they bought. Now why did I do that?"
"Because you're a good man," the grandmother said at once.
"Yes'm, I suppose so,"
Red Sam said as if he were struck with this answer. His wife brought the orders, carrying the 5 plates all at once without a tray, 2 in each hand and 1 balanced on her arm.
"It isn't a soul in this green world of gods that you can trust," she said.
"And I don't count nobody out of that, not nobody," she repeated, looking at Red Sammy.
"Did you read about that criminal, the misfit that's escaped?" asked the grandmother.
"I wouldn't be a bit surprised if he didn't attack this place right here," said the woman.
"If he hears about it being here, I wouldn't be none surprised to see him. If he hears it's 2 cents in the cash register, I wouldn't be at all surprised if he..."
"That'll do," Red Sam said. "Go bring these people the Coca-Colas."
And the woman went off to get the rest of the order.
"Good man is hard to find," Red Sammy said. "Everything's getting terrible. I remember the day you could go off and leave your screen door unlatched. Not no more."
He and the grandmother discussed better times. The old lady said that in her opinion, Europe was entirely to blame for the way things were now. She said the way Europe acted, you would think we were made of money. And Red Sam said it was no use talking about it. She was exactly right. The children ran outside into the white sunlight and looked at the monkey in the lacy chinaberry tree. He was busy catching fleas on himself and biting each one carefully between his teeth as if it were a delicacy. They drove off again into the hot afternoon. The grandmother took cat naps and woke up every few minutes with her own snoring. Outside of Toomsboro, she woke up and recalled an old plantation that she had visited in this neighborhood once when she was a young lady. She said the house had 6 white columns across the front, and that there was an avenue of oaks leading up to it, and 2 little wooden trellis arbors on either side in front, where you sat down with your suitor after a stroll in the garden. She recalled exactly which road to turn off to get to it. She knew that Bailey would not be willing to lose any time looking at an old house, but the more she talked about it, the more she wanted to see it once again, and find out if the little twin arbors were still standing. "There was a secret panel in this house," she said craftily, not telling the truth but wishing that she were. "And the story went that all the family silver was hidden in it when Sherman came through, but it was never found."
"Hey," John Wesley said, "let's go see it. We'll find it. We'll poke all the woodwork and find it. Who lives there? Where'd you turn off at? Hey, Pop, can't we turn off there?"
"We never have seen a house with a secret panel,"
Junestar shrieked.
"Let's go to the house with the secret panel. Hey, Pop, can't we go see the house with the secret panel?"
"It's not far from here, I know," the grandmother said. "It wouldn't take over 20 minutes. Bailey was looking straight ahead. His jaw was as rigid as a horseshoe.
"No,"
he said. The children began to yell and scream that they wanted to see the house with the secret panel. John Wesley kicked the back of the front seat, and June Starr hung over her mother's shoulder and whined desperately into her ear that they never had any fun, even on their vacation, that they could never do what they wanted to do. The baby began to scream, and John Wesley kicked the back of the seat so hard that his father could feel the blows in his kidney.
"All right,"
he shouted, and drew the car to a stop at the side of the road.
"Will you all shut up? Will you all just shut up for 1 second? If you don't shut up, we won't go anywhere."
"It would be very educational for them," the grandmother murmured.
"All right," Bailey said. "But get this. This is the only time we're going to stop for anything like this. This is the one and only time."
"The dirt road that you have to turn down is about a mile back," the grandmother directed. "I marked it when we passed."
"A dirt road," Bailey groaned.
After they had turned around and were headed toward the dirt road, the grandmother recalled other points about the house. The beautiful glass over the front doorway and the candle lamp in the hall. John Wesley said that the secret panel was probably in the fireplace.
"You can't go inside this house," Bailey said. "You don't know who lives there."
"While you all talk to the people in front, I'll run around behind getting a window,"
John Wesley suggested.
"We'll all stay in the car,"
his mother said. They turned onto the dirt road, and the car raced roughly along in a swirl of pink dust. The grandmother recalled the times when there were no paved roads, and 30 miles was a day's journey. The dirt road was hilly, and there were sudden washes in it and sharp curves on dangerous embankments. All at once they would be on a hill, looking down over the blue tops of trees for miles around. Then the next minute, they would be in a red depression, with the dust-coated trees looking down on them.
"This place had better turn up in a minute," Bailey said, "or I'm going to turn around."
The road looked as if no one had traveled on it in months. "It's not much farther," the grandmother said. And just as she said it, a horrible thought came to her. The thought was so embarrassing that she turned red in the face, and her eyes dilated, and her feet jumped up, upsetting her valise in the corner. The instant the valise moved, the newspaper top she had over the basket under it rose with a snarl, and Pity Sing, the cat, sprang onto Bailey's shoulder. The children were thrown to the floor, and their mother, clutching the baby, was thrown out the door onto the ground. The old lady was thrown into the front seat. The car turned over once and landed right side up in a gulch off the side of the road. Bailey remained in the driver's seat with the cat, gray-striped with a broad white face and an orange nose, clinging to his neck like a caterpillar. As soon as the children saw they could move their arms and legs, they scrambled out of the car shouting,
"We've had an accident!"
The grandmother was curled up under the dashboard, hoping she was injured so that Bailey's wrath would not come down on her all at once. The horrible thought she had had before the accident was that the house she had remembered so vividly was not in Georgia, but in Tennessee. Bailey removed the cat from his neck with both hands and flung it out the window against the side of a pine tree. Then he got out of the car and started looking for the children's mother. She was sitting against the side of the red gutted ditch, holding the screaming baby, but she only had a cut down her face and a broken shoulder.
"We've had an accident!"
the children screamed in a frenzy of delight.
"But nobody's killed," June Starr said with disappointment, as the grandmother limped out of the car, her hat still pinned to her head, but the broken front brim standing up at a jaunty angle, and the violet spray hanging off the side.
They all sat down in the ditch, except the children, to recover from the shock. They were all shaking.
"Maybe a car will come along," said the children's mother hoarsely. "I believe I have injured an organ," said the grandmother, pressing her side, but no one answered her. Bailey's teeth were clattering. He had on a yellow sport shirt with bright blue parrots designed in it, and his face was as yellow as the shirt. The grandmother decided that she would not mention that the house was in Tennessee. The road was about 10 feet above, and they could see only the tops of the trees on the other side of it. Behind the ditch they were sitting in, there were more woods, tall and dark and deep.
In a few minutes, they saw a car some distance away on top of a hill, coming slowly, as if the occupants were watching them. The grandmother stood up and waved both arms dramatically to attract their attention. The car continued to come on slowly, disappeared around a bend, and appeared again, moving even slower. On top of the hill, they had gone over. It was a big, black, battered, hearse-like automobile. There were three men in it. It came to a stop just over them, and for some minutes, the driver looked down with a steady, expressionless gaze to where they were sitting, and didn't speak. Then he turned his head and muttered something to the other two, and they got out. One was a fat boy in black trousers and a red sweatshirt, with a silver stallion embossed on the front of it. He moved around on the right side of them and stood staring, his mouth partly open in a kind of loose grin. The other had on khaki pants and a blue striped coat, and a gray hat pulled down very low, hiding most of his face. He came around slowly on the left side. Neither spoke. The driver got out of the car and stood by the side of it, looking down at them. He was an older man than the other two. His hair was just beginning to gray, and he wore silver-rimmed spectacles that gave him a scholarly look. He had a long, creased face and didn't have on any shirt or undershirt. He had on blue jeans that were too tight for him and was holding a black hat and a gun. The two boys also had guns.
"We've had an accident,"
the children screamed. The grandmother had the peculiar feeling that the bespectacled man was someone she knew. His face was as familiar to her as if she'd known him all her life, but she could not recall who he was. He moved away from the car and began to come down the embankment, placing his feet carefully so that he wouldn't slip. He had on tan and white shoes and no socks, and his ankles were red and thin.
"Good afternoon," he said. "I see you all had a little spill."
"We turned over twice," said the grandmother.
"Once," he corrected. "We've seen it happen. Try their car and see will it run, Hiram," he said quietly to the boy with the gray hat.
"What you got that gun for?"
John Wesley asked.
"What you gonna do with that gun?"
"Lady," the man said to the children's mother, "would you mind calling them children to sit down by you? Children make me nervous. I want all y'all to sit down right together there where you're at."
"What are you telling us what to do for?"
June Star asked. Behind them, the line of woods gaped like a dark open mouth.
"Come here," said their mother.
"Look here now," Bailey began suddenly. "We're in a predicament. We're in..."
The grandmother shrieked. She scrambled to her feet and stood staring.
"You're the misfit," she said. "I recognized you at once."
"Yes'm,"
the man said, smiling slightly as if he were pleased in spite of himself to be known.
"But it would have been better for all of you, lady, if you hadn't recognized me."
Bailey turned his head sharply and said something to his mother that shocked even the children. The old lady began to cry, and the misfit reddened.
"Lady," he said, "don't you get upset. Sometimes a man says things he don't mean. I don't reckon he meant to talk to you that way."
"You wouldn't shoot a lady, would you?"
the grandmother said, and removed a clean handkerchief from her cuff and began to slap at her eyes with it. The misfit pointed the toe of his shoe into the ground and made a little hole and then covered it up again.
"I would hate to have to," he said.
"Listen,"
the grandmother almost screamed.
"I know you're a good man. You don't look a bit like you have common blood. I know you must come from nice people."
"Yes, ma'am," he said. "Finest people in the world."
When he smiled, he showed a row of strong white teeth.
"God never made a finer woman than my mother, and my daddy's heart was pure gold," he said.
The boy with the red sweatshirt had come around behind them and was standing with his gun at his hip. The misfit squatted down on the ground.
"Watch them children, Bobby Lee," he said. "You know they make me nervous."
He looked at the six of them huddled together in front of him, and he seemed to be embarrassed, as if he couldn't think of anything to say.
"Ain't a cloud in the sky," he remarked, looking up at it.
Don't see no sun. Don't see no cloud neither.
Yes, it's a beautiful day, said the grandmother. Listen, she said, you shouldn't call yourself the misfit, because I know you're a good man at heart. I can just look at you and tell.
Hush, Bailey yelled. Hush! Everybody shut up and let me handle this.
He was squatting in the position of a runner about to sprint forward, but he didn't move.
I appreciate that, lady,
the misfit said, and drew a little circle in the ground with the butt of his gun.
It'll take half an hour to fix this here car,
Hiram called, looking over the raised hood of it.
Well, first you and Bobby Lee get him and that little boy to step over yonder with you,
the misfit said, pointing to Bailey and John Wesley.
The boys want to ask you something,
he said to Bailey.
Would you mind stepping back in them woods there with them? Listen, Bailey began. We're in a terrible predicament. Nobody realizes what this is.
And his voice cracked. His eyes were as blue and intense as the parrots in his shirt, and he remained perfectly still. The grandmother reached up to adjust her hat brim as if she were going to the woods with him, but it came off in her hand. She stood staring at it, and after a second she let it fall on the ground. Hiram pulled Bailey up by the arm as if he were assisting an old man. John Wesley caught hold of his father's hand, and Bobby Lee followed. They went off toward the woods, and just as they reached the dark edge, Bailey turned, and supporting himself against a gray naked pine trunk, he shouted,
I'll be back in a minute, Mama. Wait on me.
Come back this instant,
his mother shrilled, but they all disappeared into the woods.
Bailey, boy,
the grandmother called in a tragic voice, but she found she was looking at the misfit, squatting on the ground in front of her.
I just know you're a good man, she said desperately. You're not a bit common.
No, I ain't a good man,
the misfit said after a second, as if he had considered her statement carefully.
But I ain't the worst in the world neither. My daddy said I was a different breed of dog from my brothers and sisters. You know, daddy said, it's some that can live their whole life out without asking about it, and it's others has to know why it is. And this boy is one of the latters. He's going to be into everything.
He put on his black hat and looked up suddenly and then away deep into the woods as if he were embarrassed again.
I'm sorry I don't have a shirt on before you ladies, he said, hunching his shoulders slightly. We buried our clothes that we had on when we escaped, and we're just making do until we can get better. We borrowed these from some folks we met, he explained.
That's perfectly all right, the grandmother said. Maybe Bailey has an extra shirt in his suitcase.
I'll look and see directly, the misfit said.
Where are they taking him?
The children's mother screamed.
Daddy was a card himself, the misfit said. You couldn't put anything over on him. He never got in trouble with the authorities, though. Just had the knack of handling them.
You could be honest, too, if you'd only try, said the grandmother. Think how wonderful it would be to settle down and live a comfortable life and not have to think about somebody chasing you all the time.
The misfit kept scratching in the ground with the butt of his gun, as if he were thinking about it.
Yes'm, somebody is always after you, he murmured.
The grandmother noticed how thin his shoulder blades were just behind his hat, because she was standing up looking down on him.
Do you ever pray? She asked.
He shook his head. All she saw was the black hat wiggle between his shoulder blades.
No,
he said. There was a pistol shot from the woods, followed closely by another. Then silence. The old lady's head jerked around. She could hear the wind move through the treetops like a long, satisfied insuck of breath.
Bailey, boy, she called.
I was a gospel singer for a while, the misfit said. I've been most everything.
Been in the armed service, both land and sea, at home and abroad. Been twice married. Been an undertaker. Been with the railroads. Plowed Mother Earth. Been in a tornado. Seen a man burn alive once.
And he looked up at the children's mother and the little girl, who were sitting close together, their faces white and their eyes glassy.
I even seen a woman flogged.
He said, "Pray, pray," the grandmother began. "Pray, pray."
I never was a bad boy that I remember of,
the misfit said in an almost dreamy voice.
But somewheres along the line I done something wrong and got sent to the penitentiary. I was buried alive.
And he looked up and held her attention to him by a steady stare.
That's when you should have started to pray, she said. What did you do to get sent to the penitentiary that first time?
Turn to the right. It was the wall,
the misfit said, looking up again at the cloudless sky.
Turn to the left. It was a wall. Look up, it was a ceiling. Look down, it was a floor. I forget what I done, lady. I sat there, trying to remember what it was I done, and I ain't recalled it to this day.
Once in a while, I would think it was coming to me, but it never come.
Maybe they put you in by mistake,
the old lady said vaguely.
No, he said, it was no mistake.
They had the papers on me.
You must have stolen something, she said.
The misfit sneered slightly.
Nobody had nothing I wanted, he said.
It was a head doctor at the penitentiary said what I had done was kill my daddy. But I known that for a lie. My daddy died in 19-odd-19 of the epidemic flu, and I never had a thing to do with it. He's buried in the Mount Hope Well Baptist Churchyard, and you can go there and see for yourself.
If you would pray,
the old lady said,
Jesus would help you.
That's right, the misfit said.
Well then, why don't you pray?
She asked, trembling with delight suddenly.
I don't want no help, he said. I'm doing all right by myself.
Bobby Lee and Hiram came ambling back from the woods. Bobby Lee was dragging a yellow shirt with bright blue parrots in it.
Throw me that shirt, Bobby Lee,
the misfit said. The shirt came flying at him and landed on his shoulder, and he put it on. The grandmother couldn't name what the shirt reminded her of.
No, lady, the misfit said while he was buttoning it up. I found out the crime don't matter. You can do one thing or you can do another. Kill a man or take a tire off his car. Because sooner or later you're going to forget what it was you done and just be punished for it.
The children's mother had begun to make heaving noises as if she couldn't get her breath.
Lady, he asked, would you and that little girl like to step off yonder with Bobby Lee and Hiram and join your husband?
Yes, thank you,
the mother said faintly. Her left arm dangled helplessly, and she was holding the baby, who had gone to sleep, in the other.
Help that lady up, Hiram,
the misfit said, as she struggled to climb out of the ditch.
And Bobby Lee, you hold on to that little girl's hand.
I don't want to hold hands with him,
June Star said.
He reminds me of a pig.
The fat boy blushed and laughed and caught her by the arm and pulled her off into the woods after Hiram and her mother. Alone with the misfit, the grandmother found that she had lost her voice. There was not a cloud in the sky, nor any sun. There was nothing around her but woods. She wanted to tell him that he must pray. She opened and closed her mouth several times before anything came out. Finally, she found herself saying,
Jesus, Jesus,
meaning, Jesus will help you. But the way she was saying it, it sounded as if she might be cursing.
Yes'm, the misfit said as if he agreed. Jesus thrown everything off balance. It was the same case with him as with me, except he hadn't committed any crime, and they could prove I had committed one because they had the papers on me. Of course, he said, they never shown me my papers.
That's why I sign myself now. I said long ago, you get a signature and sign everything you do and keep a copy of it. Then you'll know what you done, and you can hold up the crime to the punishment and see, do they match? And in the end, you'll have something to prove you ain't been treated right. I call myself the misfit, he said, because I can't make what all I done wrong fit, what all I gone through in punishment. There was a piercing scream from the woods, followed closely by a pistol report. Does it seem right to you, lady, that one is punished a heap and another ain't punished at all?
Jesus, the old lady cried. You've got good blood. I know you wouldn't shoot a lady. I know you come from nice people. Pray, Jesus, you ought not to shoot a lady. I'll give you all the money I've got.
Lady, the misfit said, looking beyond her far into the woods. There never was a body that give the undertaker a tip. There were two more pistol reports, and the grandmother raised her head like a parched old turkey hen, crying for water, and called,
Bailey boy, Bailey boy,
as if her heart would break. Jesus was the only one that ever raised the dead, the misfit continued, and he shouldn't have done it. He'd thrown everything off balance. If he did what he said, then it's nothing for you to do but throw away everything and follow him. And if he didn't, then it's nothing for you to do but enjoy the few minutes you got left the best way you can, by killing somebody or burning down his house or doing some other meanness to him. No pleasure but meanness, he said, and his voice had become almost a snarl.
Maybe he didn't raise the dead, the old lady mumbled,
not knowing what she was saying and feeling so dizzy that she sank down in the ditch with her legs twisted under her.
I wasn't there, so I can't say he didn't, the misfit said. I wished I had have been there, he said, hitting the ground with his fist. It ain't right I wasn't there, because if I had been there, I would have known. Listen, lady, he said in a high voice. If I had have been there, I would have known, and I wouldn't be like I am now.
His voice seemed about to crack, and the grandmother's head cleared for an instant. She saw the man's face twisted close to her own, as if he were going to cry, and she murmured,
Why, you're one of my babies. You're one of my own children.
She reached out and touched him on the shoulder. The misfit sprang back as if a snake had bitten him, and shot her three times through the chest. Then he put his gun down on the ground and took off his glasses, and began to clean them. Hiram and Bobby Lee returned from the woods and stood over the ditch, looking down at the grandmother who half sat and half lay in a puddle of blood, with her legs crossed under her like a child's, and her face smiling up at the cloudless sky. Without his glasses, the misfit's eyes were red-rimmed and pale and defenseless-looking.
Take her off and throw her where you've thrown the others, he said,
picking up the cat that was rubbing itself against his leg.
She was a talker, wasn't she?
Bobby Lee said, sliding down the ditch with a yodel.
She would have been a good woman, the misfit said, if it had been somebody there to shoot her every minute of her life.
Some fun, Bobby Lee said.
Shut up, Bobby Lee, the misfit said. It's no real pleasure in life.
The river. The child stood glum and limp in the middle of the dark living room while his father pulled him into a plaid coat. His right arm was hung in the sleeve, but the father buttoned the coat anyway and pushed him forward toward a pale-spotted hand that stuck through the half-open door.
He ain't fixed right,
a loud voice said from the hall.
Well, then, for Christ's sakes, fix him, the father muttered. It's 6 o'clock in the morning.
He was in his bathrobe and barefooted. When he got the child to the door and tried to shut it, he found her looming in it, a speckled skeleton in a long pea-green coat and felt helmet. And here's in my car fare, she said. It'll be twice we have to ride the car.
He went in the bedroom again to get the money, and when he came back, she and the boy were both standing in the middle of the room. She was taking stock.
"I couldn't smell those dead cigarette butts long if I was ever to come sit with you," she said, shaking him down in his coat.
"Here's the change," the father said.
He went to the door and opened it wide and waited. After she had counted the money, she slipped it somewhere inside her coat and walked over to a watercolor hanging near the phonograph.
"I know what time it is," she said, peering closely at the black lines crossing into broken planes of violent color. "I ought to. My shift goes on at 10 p.m. and don't get off till 5, and it takes me 1 hour to ride the Vine Street car."
"Oh, I see," he said. "Well, we'll expect him back tonight, about 8 or 9.
"Maybe later," she said. "We're going to the river to healing. This particular preacher don't get around this way often. I wouldn't have paid for that," she said, nodding at the painting. "I would have drew it myself."
"All right, Mrs. Conham, we'll see you then," he said, drumming on the door. A toneless voice called from the bedroom.
"Bring me an ice pack." "Too bad his mama's sick," Mrs. Conham said. "What's her trouble?"
"We don't know," he muttered.
"We'll ask the preacher to pray for her. He's healed a lot of folks. The Reverend Bevel Summers. Maybe she ought to see him sometime."
"Maybe so," he said. "We'll see you tonight." And he disappeared into the bedroom and left them to go.
The little boy stared at her silently, his nose and eyes running. He was 4 or 5. He had a long face and bulging chin, and half-shut eyes set far apart. He seemed mute and patient, like an old sheep waiting to be let out.
"You'll like this preacher," she said. "The Reverend Bevel Summers, you ought to hear him sing."
The bedroom door opened suddenly, and the father stuck his head out and said,
"Goodbye, old man. Have a good time."
"Goodbye,"
the little boy said, and jumped as if he had been shot. Mrs. Conan gave the watercolor another look. Then they went out into the hall and rang for the elevator.
"I wouldn't have drew it," she said.
Outside, the gray morning was blocked off on either side by the unlit empty buildings.
"It's going to be fair up later," she said. "But this is the last time we'll be able to have any preaching at the river this year. Wipe your nose, sugar boy."
He began rubbing his sleeve across it, but she stopped him.
"That ain't nice," she said. "Where's your handkerchief?"
He put his hands in his pockets and pretended to look for it while she waited. "Some people don't care how they send one off," she murmured to her reflection in the coffee shop window. "You provide." She took a red and blue flowered handkerchief out of her pocket and stooped down and began to work on his nose.
"Now blow," she said, and he blew. "You can borrow it. Put it in your pocket."
He folded it up and put it in his pocket carefully, and they walked onto the corner and leaned against the side of a closed drugstore to wait for the car. Mrs. Conan turned up her coat collar so that it met her hat in the back. Her eyelids began to droop, and she looked as if she might go to sleep against the wall. The little boy put a slight pressure on her hand.
"What's your name?"
she asked in a drowsy voice.
"I don't know, but only your last name. I should have found out your first name."
His name was Harry Ashfield, and he had never thought at any time before of changing it.
"Bevel," he said.
Mrs. Conan raised herself from the wall.
"Why, ain't that a coincidence?" she said. "I told